The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Later in the show, we're going to hear from Neve Eastwood. She's the executive director of a UK drug policy reform nonprofit called Release. She's brilliant. I had the honor of meeting her once years ago. She's just brilliant. If you can't tell, I'm a fan. But first, according to the most recent data from the CDC, in 2019, a total of 71,999 people died from a drug overdose. Often the cause of death is determined by an EMT or a physician without any autopsy, certainly not a real forensic medical examination. They call it on the spot. But what if they're getting it wrong? That's not a rhetorical question. Loyal listeners know that I edit Drug War Facts. I'm a data nerd. I'm into the numbers. The idea that some deaths could be misreported, I mean, it isn't all that surprising, but, well, here, let's just get to it. Dr. Janssen is lead author of a piece that was published August 10th in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine. The title is Occult Overdose Masquerading as Sudden Cardiac Death from the Postmortem Systematic Investigation of Sudden Cardiac Death Study.
So I'm a cardiac electrophysiologist and a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School. That means I'm a heart rhythm specialist. That's my clinical specialty. And my research focuses on sudden cardiac death, specifically fatal arrhythmias, dangerous rhythms that cause sudden death. I have a large research program dedicated to uncovering all the underlying causes of sudden death.
First, for my own benefit as well as that of the listeners, what is an occult overdose?
So it's worth taking a step back to explain the parent study and why we call it an occult overdose. So as you alluded to before, a lot of causes of death, particularly out-of-hospital death, are presumed because a full investigation is rarely done. The exceptions being potential criminal death, like homicides or suicides or trauma death. But natural death, particularly those assumed to be due to cardiac arrest, are rarely investigated. They're assumed to be cardiac. Early on in my career, my focus was on the genetics of sudden cardiac death. And I stumbled upon the realization that the way we define sudden cardiac death, we really have no idea. It's a complete guess that the cause of death is cardiac when somebody collapses suddenly. So I partnered with the medical examiner in San Francisco, and we've done a comprehensive post-mortem investigation of every sudden death in San Francisco County since 2011, and that includes autopsy and toxicology. And our main findings of the post-SCD study, the post-mortem systematic investigation of sudden cardiac death, that study was published in Circulation a couple of years ago. And so this was a sub-study of the parent study focusing on drug overdose causes of sudden death. So getting back to your question of occult overdose. So it turns out that when you take all of these events that were presumed cardiac by paramedics and presumed cardiac by the medical examiner or the coroner, about half of them are not cardiac at all. And to really study the underlying causes in the genetics, you really have to hone down on the true cardiac causes. That's my focus. But among the non-cardiac causes, the largest cause, the biggest surprise, was these deaths were actually found to be due to overdose. And the only way we found that was systematic toxicology, and every one of these deaths presumed to be cardiac. And hence, I called them occult overdose, because had we not known by toxicology, they would have counted as a cardiac arrest death. In fact, throughout the country and in the world, every single county, every single city these hundreds of thousands of cardiac arrest deaths are presumed cardiac. And because we're the only ones to systematically look post-mortem, we found that 1 in 6 of these deaths are actually overdoses. These are hidden because they're counted as cardiac arrest deaths in any other statistic throughout the world. And so we feel like this has broad implications for, undercounting of the burden of overdose, burden of drug use and overdose in the country and in the world. So hence the title, Occult Overdose Deaths Masquerading as Suicide.
One out of 1/6. Well, no, so just to get an idea of the scope of this, I mean, how many deaths are we talking about? I mean, in the sample, for instance.
So, in the parent study, this is, over 700 deaths that we looked at, over 700 cardiac arrest deaths. So these are deaths that the paramedics have called cardiac arrest. And 1 in 6 of those, of the ones that the paramedics presumed cardiac, were actually overdose deaths.
That's a lot of people. How many, nationally, do you have any idea? How many people,
So that's a great question. I mean, if you look at national statistics of overdose deaths that are published that are based upon recognized overdoses, we did a back of the envelope calculation and, we would say that the overdose death rate in the country is probably underestimated by half. So somewhere in the order of 60,000 deaths are documented to be due to overdose. These are recognized overdoses, right? So if you extrapolate our findings up to so, we estimated about double the overdose death over what is recognized.
That'd be around 70,000 people.
Oh. Yes, exactly. So. Yeah, wow. I mean, whatever the current numbers, national statistics on overdose deaths, we think it's double that amount if you extrapolate our data.
Okay, while I try and absorb that, let me ask you another question. Wow. It seems obvious that we would want to know the real causes of death per people, but aside from just having accurate statistical reporting, can tell me what other impacts are there from the inaccurately categorizing all these deaths?
Absolutely. So it's huge implications from every single medical specialty is touched upon here. Because the way they define sudden cardiac death is somebody collapses within an hour of their symptoms. The paramedic primary impression upon coming to the scene of a victim, that's how an event is defined as cardiac or not. And rarely, outside of our study, the post-SED study, rarely are these deaths investigated with autopsy and toxicology. So they're always presumed to be cardiac. So if you look at national statistics on causes of death, which are based on death certificates, which are presumed, not only are overdose deaths undercounted, but many of the other non-cardiac causes of sudden death are undercounted. And what I mean by that are things like stroke, hemorrhages, pulmonary embolisms, infections, ruptures of aneurysms, all of those look like a cardiac event until you do the autopsy and uncover that it was actually a non-cardiac cause. And so, again, in our parent study, if you extrapolate those findings, cardiac causes of death, sudden death, are overcounted by double. And collectively, all the non-cardiac causes of sudden death, occult overdose being the largest of the non-cardiac causes, are undercounted by double. And you can't, starting with natural statistics, but going beyond that into the basic science realm and to what we try to do with doctors to counsel patients and uncover risk factors, and then down to the basic science studies, it's hard to do those studies if you don't have an accurate cause of death. Basically, many of our causes of death, national statistics, CEC, AHA estimates, etc., are pure guesses, presumed because of death.
I should ask, the drugs that were involved, let's get to the overdose deaths, the drugs that were involved, legal, prescription, illegal, non-prescription, what kind of patterns did you find
there? Great question. So it turns out, no surprise, that it's a combination. Approximately half of them were opiate-related, but we also had... prescription drugs. So not all of these overdoses were illicit drug use, but prescribed drugs, whether it be opiates or prescribed medical prescriptions that the victim may have inadvertently taken too much of their medicines, or they didn't clear their medicines properly because of kidney problems or liver problems. But among the other illicit causes of illicit classes of drugs, of course, we had methamphetamines, cocaine, many of the other drug classes were represented. So approximately half of these are prescribed drugs.
Again, folks, we're talking to Dr. Xian Sen. He's lead author of a piece that was published August 10th in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine, Occult Overdose Masquerading as Sudden Cardiac Death, from the Postmortem Systematic Investigation of Sudden Cardiac Death Study. Now, the patients that you were looking at in your study, was there a particular age group? I mean, cardiac arrest, one would presume that they're all primarily older, but was there an age range?
Yeah, so one of the important aspects of our study is that we did not have any age restrictions. So anybody over age 18 all the way up to 90, we included in the county limits of San Francisco. And so all comers, cardiac arrest, assumed to be cardiac between age 18 to 90. And so another one of the surprising findings was that many of these occult overdoses were people in their 60s and 70s, where they collapse and the paramedics think it's cardiac arrest, and it turns out to be occult overdoses. So this overdose problem is not simply a young person's issue.
I hate to assert that someone is exhibiting bias, but possibly someone in their 60s or 70s, someone's not going to look at and think, oh, they must have suffered an overdose. They're just going to assume heart attack.
Absolutely.
Which leads to the treatment question. Oh, my heaven.
Exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, many of these victims may not necessarily be illicitly using drugs, but using their opiates as prescribed, right? And overdose because they took too much of it, or in combination some of their prescribed medicine.
Combinations are increasingly common. I mean, the interactions aren't really appreciated, and they aren't necessarily explained for one reason or another. So that's just, it's kind of not surprising that's what you found it's not surprising at all. I've got that right in front of me. Persons with overdose tested positive for multiple intoxicants, 75.9% of persons in the initial period and 55.6% in the extended period. I hate asking this because it makes me sound dumb. What have I missed? What should I have asked you? What question is obvious out there that I haven't asked yet?
No, that's it's a very apropos question. What I haven't mentioned is, what are the implications for me as a cardiologist or paramedics coming on the scene of cardiac arrest deaths, right? And so what happens is, if paramedics are coming on the scene of these assumed cardiac events, and always assuming it's cardiac, and they may not be thinking to use some antidotes or reversal agents, for example, Narcan. And so we think some of the implications of our study could be that it may argue to broadly expand the use of antidote drugs at the scene of resuscitation. It's a very inexpensive medicine and very quick to administer at the scene of a resuscitation. And so many of these are potentially reversible, and we could potentially save many of these overdose victims.
That's... Doctor, any closing thoughts for our listeners?
No, I think you know, again, I the main goal of our study was to uncover the true causes of sudden death, to make an impact on reducing mortality overall. And this is a very important, we thought a very important sub study and an important finding to disseminate to the broader audience.
I absolutely agree. Dr. Sen, thank you so much for all your time. It's been an honor speaking with you.
I appreciate your interest in the study. Thank you.
That was my interview with Dr. Xian Sen. He's a professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco Medical School. We were discussing findings from his research project, the San Francisco Postmortem Systematic Investigation of Sudden Cardiac Death Post-SCD Project. His new article, entitled Occult Overdose Masquerading as Sudden Cardiac Death from the Postmortem Systematic Investigation of Sudden Cardiac Death Study, was published August 10th in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now, as promised, let's hear from Neve Eastwood, executive director of the UK drug policy reform nonprofit Release. She spoke recently on a webinar entitled Street Drugs Discussion: What Does an Effective Drug Policy Look Like?
My name is Neve Eastwood. I'm executive director of Release. Release is the UK center of expertise on drugs and drug laws. We provide legal expert drug services to people who use drugs, and we campaign for reform of the drug laws, based on policies and approaches that are commensurate with the evidence and that focus on the individuals, both in terms of their dignity, that they are treated with equality, and respect. I'm happy to talk more about what Release does and the questions. So James has outlined kind of some of the things that he wants Daniel and I to pick up on. And so to start with kind of the failures of the current UK drug policy, many of you will know this, but the main focus of the prohibitionist framework within the UK is a criminal justice one. So we overwhelmingly respond to drug use as a criminal justice issue. And I think that's evidenced when we look at the spend on law enforcement in the UK annually. So the Home Office has stated that we spend $1.6 billion on drug law enforcement annually, every year. And their own evaluation of that activity has shown that it has little to no impact on the supply of drugs and describes the drug market as resilient. But the point of this, and I think saying that it's a criminal justice approach is fair when we look, say, for example, for the budget lines for treatment. So we spend about $600 million a year on treatment, so almost a third less than we do on law enforcement. And those are ever-diminishing budgets in a time of austerity. At the core of this policy is the idea that criminalization would deter use, does deter use. But in fact, repeated academic studies have shown that that is not the case. And Professor Alex Stevens' work in this area is of note. More particularly, if we look at the Home Office's own evaluation again, so this was a report that they published in 2014, comparing the experiences of 14 countries across the world, some of whom had taken a less punitive approach that had ended criminal sanctions for possession offences, and others that were much tougher in their response, so like Japan and Sweden. And what that report stated at it in its conclusion was that tough law enforcement does not deter use. So this is a failed policy in terms of its own kind of central goal. But what we do know is that the current UK drug policy causes significant harms. And I think those harms are borne out in a number of areas, but just to highlight two, drug-related deaths are at the highest level since records began. And that is for the seventh year in a row. And from the work that we do, it is distressing and depressing that every year for the last 7 years, we have had to make that statement. Moreover, criminalization is not applied to all people who use drugs. Criminalization disproportionately targets young people, those who we're trying to protect within our drug policy. It targets people who live in deprivation, and it targets people of color. So research that Release has undertaken has shown that Black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched for drugs despite using drugs at a lower rate than the white population. And when they are caught in possession of drugs, which is in the vast minority of cases, they receive harsher criminal justice sanctions. So in our view at Release, drug policy, not just in the UK, but in many parts of the world, is a form of social oppression and a tool of social control and a form of racial oppression. Currently, the aim of drug policy within the UK is measured by prevalence. So success is measured by the numbers of people using drugs. So regularly, you'll hear the Home Office making statements such as drug policy in the UK is working, drug use is falling. Well, that's a misrepresentation of the stats, but it shows that for them, the main outcome is to reduce drug use, not to reduce harms. And in our view, an effective drug policy should be measured on reduction of harms. This would include deaths. As I've mentioned, we have record drug-related deaths. The UK accounts for 1 in 3 drug-related deaths in Europe. The reduction of BBVs. We've seen most recently the outbreak of a HIV transmission in Glasgow amongst people who inject drugs. We have also seen an increase in hepatitis C rates amongst people who inject drugs. These are really worrying trends. And there are other health harms obviously associated with criminalisation, as that policy will increase risky behaviours, such as injecting drugs quite quickly in order to avoid detection, therefore risk of injury. What our drug policy should focus beyond reduction of health harms is also on social and economic inclusion. And what this means in practice is investment in harm reduction, investment in treatment, investment in social inclusion policies, including housing security and improved family relations, a reduction in stigma, and a increase in economic participation. None of these things are achievable whilst we continue to criminalise people who use drugs. So at Release, what we advocate for is decriminalisation, and that is the ending of criminal sanctions for possession offences. It can be extended to other activities, but in the main, possession offences. Research, again, that we have done with the International Drug Policy Consortium, and that's published on our website, Talking Drugs, which I'd encourage you all to go to, shows that 29 countries across the globe and 49 jurisdictions, that's mainly US states and Australian states, have adopted this approach. So they have either decriminalised cannabis possession or decriminalised possession of all drugs. And in the main, it is all drugs. Cannabis possession decriminalisation is actually an outlier, mainly in the US. None of those jurisdictions saw an increase in drug use linked to the legal reforms. So those concerns that politicians have about it encouraging drug use is unfounded. And for those countries that have coupled the decriminalisation approach with investment in health, in harm reduction, in treatment, they've had really successful health, social and economic outcomes. Many of you will know about Portugal, but I am going to mention it because it is the most researched of the countries that have adopted this approach. So Portugal ended criminal sanctions for possession offences back in 2001. In the succeeding years, evidence has shown us that problematic drug use has fallen. The number of young people transitioning to heroin has fallen. There has been a significant reduction in the transmission of HIV. There is a reduction in drug-related deaths, which I will come back to. Injecting drug use fell by 40% in the first 10 years of the policy. There has been a less involvement of the criminal justice system in this activity, as it is treated as a health public health issue, a reduction in the number of people going to prison, and 10 years of the policy. So this can save money as well for governments. And unfortunately for governments who don't seem to care about the rights of individuals or the health outcomes or social outcomes, the economic arguments are strong. The Czech Republic also decriminalised drug possession back in 2010, and they have similar outcomes. And I just want to focus in on drug-related deaths. So Portugal and the Czech Republic have a drug-related death rate of 4 per million of the population. You compare that to the UK, where it is 76 per million of the population. And in fact, all of the European countries that have some form of decriminalization, that includes the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, and Spain, as well as Portugal and the Czech Republic, have lower rates of drug-related deaths than the EU average and significantly lower than the UK. So if we want a policy that improves health, social, and economic outcomes, then decriminalization is the starting point, as it will end the criminalization of all people who use all types of currently controlled drugs. If we focus on legalization and regulation, then it tends to be drug by drug. So at the moment, the only real opportunities in relation to regulation are in respect of cannabis, which is really positive, but that does nothing to reduce drug-related deaths amongst the most vulnerable population, those who use opioids. And whilst release supports regulation and we support a certain type of regulation, which I hope we'll get into in the discussion, we do not think regulation can move forward without decriminalization. And often decriminalization and regulation are set up as opposing policies, or that decriminalization is some halfway house that leaves the production and supply in the hands of unregulated suppliers. I do not think it is either a halfway house, nor do I think that it is a policy that works in opposition of regulation, but rather that decriminalization and regulation are complementary and necessary policies that must be pursued in tandem in order to reduce the harms of prohibition. And I think Canada is really instructive on this point. As many of you will know, Canada regulated cannabis back in 2018. However, they continue to possession of cannabis outside of the regulated market. So criminalization of illegal cannabis is an offence. And so returning to the point that I made at the start about the failure of our current drug policy, I highlighted the fact that criminalization focuses on those living in deprivation, people of colour, and young people. These are the people who are likely to be excluded from the regulated market in Canada as a result of the costs involved in purchasing it due to high taxation. And so those people will continue to be thrown under the bus of prohibition. So for me, the Canadian model is a failed model because it continues and repeats the harms of criminalization that decriminalization can address. So those are my points. Thank you, James.
That was Neve Eastwood, Executive Director of the UK Drug Policy Reform Nonprofit Release. She spoke recently on a webinar entitled Street Drugs Discussion, What Does an Effective Drug Policy Look Like? And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive director of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's new video project, Becker's Buds. You can find links at drugtruth.net. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.